This is Winging It Podcast, the podcast for people who don't have their shit together.
Their shit together. Their shit together. Their shit together.
We are back with Winging It, the podcast. I am Rashad Howard here with
Athena Cross
and
Rob Marriott.
Rob Marriott. This has been a long time coming for us. Actually, we're lucky to be in the presence of Rob Marriott, who is an entrepreneur, a tech entrepreneur, a musician, a creative, a writer, an investigative journalist, a hip-hop pioneer, a movie producer and director, and you name it, if it's creative or if it has anything with preserving the culture, Rob Marriott is about that life. We are happy to have him in the studio with us today.
A lot of things are good.
Yeah. That's right. That's who you are, though, bro. That's who you are. You know, quick claim to fame, Rob is one of the people, I think he was the last interview with Tupac.
Yes, that was, I think I interviewed him about a week before he was shot in Vegas.
It's crazy. Hip-hop pioneer people, Rob Marriott. So let's kind of get this thing started. It's been a quick minute since we've done this. Are you going to start with our ego check? Or am I going to start?
You start.
All right, I'm going to get you guys real cool and out of here.
I'll go one.
Gotcha. My name is Rashad Howard. I'm thoroughly excited about the opportunity to do this interview today. It's been something that, I've really appreciated the time and the opportunity to get to know you, Rob. And so today I just want to be open. I want to be in the right headspace to help you tell the story that you want to tell. And I just want to be present and attentive in these moments. And so with that, I check my ego.
I guess I'm going to check limitation, and I'm going to check self-doubt. I'm going to check, all those things that I don't usually check. I don't usually check these things. I usually only focus on the aspirational things. So today I'm going to check self-doubt, and I'm going to embrace self-love and be here and present for my good friend, Rob Marriott.
Rob, sir.
Today I'm going to check any vanity that may pop up in the mind or I'm going to take myself out of any idea of being above anybody else. Be real with myself.
We're losing our banner.
People around town talking this and that, how we sound like the R, and our music was whack. Dropped the album Strictly Business and you thought we would fold. 30 days later, the LP went gold. So what you saying? So what you saying?
All right, so the next part of our show is Day of Great Despair. And so one of the things that we try to do in this show is have people talk about their hardest moments and what it felt like to be in those moments. Our hope by sharing these stories is that we get to teach other people or show other people that they're not alone in their wretchedness and that other people are going through the same type of shit all the time.
All right, so with that, we'll take a break. We'll come right back and get into Rob's story.
Yeah, this album is dedicated to all the teachers that told me I never amount to nothing. To all the people that lived above the buildings that I was hustling from that called the police on me when I was just trying to make some money to feed my daughter. And all the niggas in the struggle, you know what I'm saying? It's all good, baby, baby. It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. Salt and pepper and Heavy D up in the limousine. Hanging pictures on my wall. Every Saturday, rap attack Mr. Magic Molly Mall. I let my tape rock till my tape pop. Smoking weed and bamboo, sipping on private stock. Way back when I had the red and black lumberjack with the hat to match. Remember rapping Duke? The ha, you never thought that hip hop would take it this far. Now I'm in the limelight cause I rhyme tight. Time to get paid, blow up like the World's Trade. Born sinner, the opposite of a winner. Remember when I used to eat sardines for dinner? Peace to Raw G, Brucey B, Kid Capri, Funk Master Flex, Love Bug Star Schemes. I'm blowing up like you thought I would. Call a crib, same number, same hood. It's all good. And if you don't know, now you know.
And we're back with Winging It Podcast, and we're sitting here with Rob Marriott. I want to just kind of get right to it. Rob, can you, you know, we know that you're from Brooklyn, New York. Brooklyn stand up.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. He's even got on the Brooklyn USA t-shirt today. Like, he came all in today. But can you tell us a little bit about you and, like, how you ended up where we are today?
I mean, I grew up in Kingston, Jamaica, in Brooklyn, New York. I came here when I was about seven. I think that's a very common story with Jamaicans of about my age. And but I grew up mostly in Brooklyn in these projects called Williamsburg Projects, which is actually Bushwick. Regular Brooklyn childhood, which meant dealing with all kinds of dangers that this generation has never had to deal with. I grew up in the real Brooklyn, you know, the actual Brooklyn that built the brand, that brought the whites. my Brooklyn was Puerto Rican and black, you know. So after elementary school, I got a scholarship to prep school, went to a boarding school in Connecticut. So I got to see both sides of American society, like the uber rich and the uber poor, and ironically they're very similar in a lot of ways. But that opportunity to kind of move through the class strata gave me a lot of insight very early. After school, started writing. I had to choose kind of between art and visual art, which was my passion, and writing. And I was like, I don't want to be a starving artist, you know. So writing seemed more a better bet. I started writing at The Voice, Village Voice. I interned there. Then in high school, I got my first published piece. So I started actually professionally writing.
Oh, wow.
About 17 in high school. And then when I went to college, I was like, I'm already doing what I need to do. And this, I went to Oberlin.
You went to Oberlin?
I didn't know that.
I didn't know Ohio? That either. I got mad people that went to Oberlin.
Yeah. Going from being in the mix of the Niggerati at the time, all of the big writers were all at The Voice. Big black writers at the time were all at The Voice, and I was in that mix. So to go to the cornfields after that was pretty hard. So I left after the first year and just started writing professionally.
Yeah. Where, wow. You said all the black writers were at. What period of time was this? And then who are we talking about?
This is I graduated high school in 90. So we're talking about Greg Tate, Nelson George, Ben Mapp, Joan Morgan, Lisa Kennedy, Lisa Jones, who's Amir Baraka's daughter, Harry Allen, Stanley Crouch, you know what I mean? Like, they were all converged at The Voice. So that was, is everything I wanted, you know, to do at that time.
Had you always been in situations where you were, I'll say, advanced and ahead and kind of, because you made a decision about writing. It seems like that was the practical decision. Like, you actually looked at writing was going to be the more practical thing to do to ensure that you made money. But writing for most people is like a dream to go and do with the hopes of making money. But for you, it was always something that seems like it just sort of came easy. Have you always been at the top of
the field, the game?
I was aware that I had talent. I was encouraged very early by my teachers. I remember, you know, from second grade being complimented on my writing and my art. So I knew I was a creative from very young. Like, that was never a question for me. I didn't think about really doing anything outside of, you know, I flirted with advertising. Mm-hmm. Because I was like, okay, maybe I can apply creativity to this business application, you know. But I worked at a advertising firm, I think in high school, and I was like, okay, this is lying. This is lying for a living. I can't, you know what I mean? Like, this doesn't make sense for me. So, you know, once I started interning at The Voice, I saw a way to kind of apply my creativity mm-hmm. to something that could actually earn me a living.
So you were at The Voice, and it sounds like you're surrounded by just, you know, excellence. What made you leave and start your own thing?
Well, what happened was that I was at The Voice for maybe 5 or 6 years, just, you know, writing, doing things. But then I got hired at The Source. And one of the things that I realized early in my writing career was that the things I wanted to write about, the audience of, like, newspapers and magazines like Spin or The Voice or whatever, I had to do a lot of translating for the audience, which is, you know, I was writing about hip hop, I was writing about urban culture, and then, you know, to make the audience understand what I was writing about, I would need, like, you know, a lot of wordage to break down what the source audience,
like could have,
you didn't have to explain who Tupac was, or you didn't have to explain the relationship between the music and the streets. But when you're writing for the Times or writing for, you know, a mainstream audience, you had to spend a lot of time unpacking. Mm-hmm. And that was very frustrating to me. I thought it took away from my poetry. You know, I tried to always write in a musical way. That was because music was my first love, and writing was, you know, me trying to get to that height, mm-hmm. you know, that height of expression. And, you know, things would happen to me when I was writing where, you know, the editor would, I think Amir Baraka once called it, deform your mastery. Which is like, I once described Biggie as like articulating ghetto dialectics, right? Mm-hmm. And I was very specific about what that meant and how it meant. And then the editor changed it into ghetto dialects. And I was like,
no.
I was fucking outraged.
he cut the syllables too. Point. Plus it was hip hop, articulating ghetto dialectics. Like that,
yeah,
that's how you say it even matters.
And, you know? and for the editor to change that, you know what I mean? Yeah. To read that and then say, you know what, he meant something.
It was a typo.
Right, you know what I mean? Like, those kind of things would be very frustrating. So working at The Source, there was a way to speak directly to the audience I wanted to speak to in the ways I wanted to speak to them.
Yeah. You'd always keep it pure.
Yeah. It was a lot less unpacking.
Yeah.
And it was a time where people were, like, reading about hip-hop culture in magazines, so it was...
Yeah, magazines print. Were the internet at that time. The source was Black Twitter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Before the technology made it possible.
Yeah.
So soon after that, you made... you know, what happened in hip-hop? Because, you know, you have some really deep insights about being there sort of at the beginning of time. And, you know, for those who haven't done enough research on Rob, he's one of the original writers. Like, he was the one that was telling stories that, as Athena was just pointing out, that young people like me, I was a few years behind you, it was about 6-7 years behind you. I was reading the source, trying to capture and understand a bit of a place that mm-hmm. I only heard in song, but wanted to live in and mm-hmm. feel. And you were one of the original authors of, like, even my imagination mm-hmm. around that.
Yeah,
and so what was like, what, you know, what happened in hip hop? What was your experience? And then what led to what happened next?
I was introduced to hip hop like everybody else in my generation through the radio and mixtapes. I heard tales about what was happening in the Bronx, but you know, I was too young to fully understand it. But me, like everybody else, you know, you had to memorize Rapper's Delight. That was, you know,
of course,
the birth of it and the birth of it for me. But there were probably like these touchstone songs, touchstone experiences that made hip hop like more than just music for me. I know that when I heard Run DMC, Suck MCs, that was like a big moment for me. That beat is, you know, that was one of those like life-shaping experiences, when that beat in particular. And then there was, Rakim was when I realized that hip-hop wasn't just a music form, it was like a paradigm shift. It was like there's a psychological shift going on. I remember Rakim said, I was in my grandmother's house in the projects, listening to the radio. I remember it was like one of those double tape deck radios. And Rakim said, can you detect what's coming next from the flex of the wrist? And that was like, oh, this is a revolution. This is not just a song, you know what I mean? There's a psychological shift that Rakim represented. And he was really the birth of my consciousness.
MC means move the crowd. I made it easy to dance to this. But can you detect what's coming next from the flex of the wrist? Say indeed, then I proceed, cause my man made a mix. Every bleed, he won't be no band-aid, a fix, a fingertip, so I'm on to the...
Just like you are talking now, you have a really great way to sort of articulate...
the ghetto dialectics.
Yeah, it's a ghetto dialectics.
Intellectual ghetto dialectics.
That's exactly, that's exactly it. And so you left Source, right? Did you?
Yes.
I just want to kind of tell you, a little bit more of your journey.
The editorial staff of the Source left because the publisher was basically getting extorted by Benzino. Benzino was trying to, you know, get favorable coverage on the editorial side.
And,
you know, Reginald C. Dennis and James Bernard and the other members of the editorial staff were really protective of our integrity. And being able to say, you know, when we reviewed something, that this was not bought and paid for or not biased. And, you know, there was so much competition amongst rappers at that time to be in the pages of the Source and to be reviewed and so on. And, you know, you didn't want to present yourself as someone who was compromised. So when the publisher kind of snuck these Benzino pages into one of the issues of the Source, even after he had threatened us and done all this stuff, it was like a bridge too far. This was like an ongoing kind of conflict with Dave May's publisher, and you know, we all just left when he pulled that maneuver. And that's when we started XXL.
Good. So you leave the Source, you hit XXL, and I don't want to just kind of skip and say the rest is hip hop, but there's a period of time when things started to change in hip hop, and I've heard Fat Joe talk about, I've heard a lot of people talk about like what was going on in New York, and like the energy has shifted. You mentioned the paradigm shift of the music in and of itself when listening to Rakim, but then some other things happened. I mean, you happened to be the last interview with Tupac. That was a time in hip hop where the energy was just starting to really get, for lack of a better word, toxic. And then that I feel like, did that force you to make some sort of personal paradigm shifts or changes in your own life to get out of Dodge and leave that space in general?
I would say that, Tupac and Biggie made me change anything in terms of my relationship to music. I always thought there was always this kind of game that you had to play when you're dealing with hip hop. There's street culture that created it, and then there was the creativity and the industry, and you had to be able to kind of go between those two worlds from the beginning. So Tupac and Biggie were victims of having to live in those two worlds. You know what I mean? Not to skip ahead, but this is kind of what I'm working on now in trying to document that whole process, you know, what was actually going on at that time and what the challenges were being part of a revolutionary movement that was co-opted by corporate America.
So when did you make a decision to just walk away from it? When did you make a decision to shift, I should say, from, you know, being right in the middle of hip hop, sort of chronicling it, to where you are now? Because I've known you for a really long time, and I recognize a shift in you and your focus. What caused that? Like, when did that sort of turn in the Rob Marriott story start to happen?
Well, I think if there was a shift at any point was when I decided to move to Africa, and that was right after 9/11. I thought I happened to be in Africa at the time that 9/11 happened. I was in Rome when the buildings actually fell, and then the next day I went to the Ivory Coast, and it was my first time in Africa, and it was such a stark difference between how the West, me being in Italy and in Europe when it hit, and how the West reacted to that, and how Africa reacted to it. Mm. You know, in the Ivory Coast, it was just like some small bomb happened somewhere.
It's crazy.
In Europe, it was like the world was collapsing. You know what I mean? And I was like, I think I want to be on this, on the African side of this equation right now. And I start, you know, that was part of a process of me having gone to every city in America, every chocolate city in America, and starting to feel like I wasn't seeing any new stories.
Mm.
I wasn't writing about anything new. I kind of covered the West Coast, covered the South, covered the Midwest, you know, and wanting to now kind of open up and be more global. So that was like, I guess, the big shift, if anything.
Yeah.
So with that, we're going to take another quick break and then come back in just a moment. We're going to dive into what it was like to leave the source and then return to the source. Just in a moment. Just in a moment. Just in a moment.
we are back with Winging It, the podcast, with our guest, Rob Marriott. And right before the break, we were talking about, you know, returning to the source, going to Africa and being immersed in culture and in the place when you were looking for new stories and new sort of ways that we can interpret this experience on our world. So tell me a little bit more about, what is it you found when you got to Africa, when you got there and you were like, I'm seeing something different. What was it you found that made you stay there for 10 years?
Well, at the end of the day, you know, I found love, actually. If I really am honest about what made me move, it was actually meeting my wife and having a long-distance relationship for 5 years. She was she worked in Italy, and I was in the U.S. and then she moved to started working in Iraq. So we were going back and forth a lot, and then we were trying to figure out how we were actually going to be together in one place, and Africa was kind of that answer. But for me personally, also, as you know, in terms of work, Africa was kind of a natural next step for me, because, you know, to go back to what you were saying, that, you know, I was in the hip hop industry. And in the hip hop industry, it wasn't just about the music and the culture, it was also about the business and the money and so on. And playing that game, I started to kind of become a stranger to myself. And, you know, it was a lot of, you know, maneuvering and a lot of ego business. And, you know what I mean? Like, I was creating this kind of myth around myself that was making me make terrible decisions.
So you believed the hype?
I started believing my hype, definitely, and I also wasn't doing things that were good for me or my family, or, you know what I mean? Like, I was choosing, things that would bring me money or fame or what, as opposed to doing things that were really based in my original love for creating and being an artist. And I think it reflected in me being bored and just doing things for the wrong reason. So with Africa, it was like going back down to that original. So I never left hip hop. I left the industry.
Yo, them niggas got them going up to see Captain Kirk like a jerk and they out of work. Let me tell y'all a little something, man. A lot of people on daytime radio scared of us because they too ignorant to understand the lyrics of the truth that we pumping into them clouds, that brain cells, that they're spotting under them wooden skulls they call caps, you know what I'm saying? But the S1s are straightening it out quick, fast, in a hurry. Don't worry, flavor vision ain't blurry, you know what I'm saying?
What I discovered in Africa was hip hop. You know, I discovered the origins of the culture, and that's always been my kind of motivation, my reason for intellectually investigating the music, was trying to understand where it came from. So, you know, if you look at it, I actually moved to the South Bronx before I moved to Africa. So I was going deeper into the source.
So that's real. I feel like, you know, if I was to pull a string thematically through a lot of things, I would hear purity, the source, the origin, even the reason why you wanted to, or why everyone ended up leaving the Village Voice, came down to them taking away from the integrity of the writing and the purity of what was going on. And then it, you know, and it goes on to the source and everything else. And so what did you find at the source? You said you found hip-hop, you heard hip-hop, you heard the origin. What did you find out about you at the source? What came, like, did you find yourself in its purity, in its purest form, in your purest creative form?
I was able to kind of see myself in a global context. Mm. I'd started to understand that what being Black in America was just being something that was cut from its origins and source, but somehow still being itself. It's like, you know, yeah. you cut a plant, mm. you cut a plant off and put it in the water, it's going to grow.
Right.
It's going to still be that plant.
Right.
You know, so all of the things that were magical and charismatic about hip hop, I was able to start to see in its, like, its rooted form.
Its
like,
it,
you know, so I'll give you an example. Like, I was in Ghana and I met this woman who was, like, super charismatic, really interesting, but she was in, like, she had like a little kiosk in the market, you know, and it was you would never know that this woman was a millionaire from her surroundings, but she was bringing sorrel leaves from Burkina Faso and selling it in Ghana, and had a very thriving business, but with none of the, you know, it was just the bags of leaves and her sitting there. But I could tell from talking to her how intelligent she was, how sharp she was, how successful she was. And I noticed her gold tooth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you were to just take a picture of her face, she could have been from Brooklyn, like, mm-hmm. easily, with the gold tooth and all. And her name was Haji Afati. And I remember her explaining to me that the gold tooth was actually representative of the fact that she took the Hajj. She was Muslim, and it was one of the seven principles that, you know, one of the seven things you have to do as a Muslim. If you have the money to afford, you have to take a trip to Mecca. And the fact that she did that gave her this title, Hajjah. You know what I mean? She was a woman who took the Hajj. Same thing with Malcolm X, you know, when he changed his name to El Hajj. That was an honorary title. And then when you look at Brooklyn and what gold teeth represent, or how it started, it was to create that honorary status. You know what I mean? Like, if somebody was able to, you know, rock a gold tooth, you were giving that status without knowing the origins of it. You know what I mean? So that I saw that in a thousand different ways in Africa.
So now that you're back here, right, how does your perspective on what you see today in, you know, hip hop and in this culture, in Black culture in the US, how does your experience as a way come back and influence your perspective on this moment? And what is your perspective on this moment?
I mean, we're at war, you know. Right now we're in a Renaissance war, but it's been a war, a psychological war between us and those who would destroy us. You know what I mean? Like the rabbits and the wolves. And the wolves have to eat, and they eat us in every possible way. You know, they take our culture, they take our actual property, they, you know, everything that we create, the wolves eat. And it's this constant battle. And Africa, you know, made that very clear to me that that's what's going on, that we have to kind of fight this war until we win.
So does that translate at all into any of the work that you're doing now?
Absolutely. That's what I'm, I feel like I'm one of the soldiers in this war. You know, Beyonce is like a general in our war. You know what I mean? Like, if you watch the Coachella movie or the performance, you know, she is destroying people with, you know, asses and dance moves. You know what I mean? Like, they can't you can't fight that. You know what I mean? It's too, the weapons are too powerful. Psychological weapons are too powerful. You have to love us. If you watch that, you know, in its entirety, if you watch what she did to create that, you know, she started overweight from twins. Pregnancy. Twins. She just had twins. They cut her open, and she's standing in front of, you know, a couple hundred dancers and people working it, not in her perfect body, you know what I mean, but ready to work. And all of the work that she did to create that psychological technology, you know what I mean? It brought me to tears watching it, you know what I mean? Like, that's what we have to do over and over and over again to kind of gain the right to be free and live in our truth. You know, you have to do those things, and you have to sacrifice on that level, because there's people really out to destroy us and destroy our freedoms.
How are you sacrificing on that level? Because I feel like Africa was your gold tooth moment, right? So you made your pilgrimage to Hajj, you know, I mean to Mecca. Mecca for you, the source was Africa. You come back, you understand what hip hop is, but you understand it in a grand, like, it's grander, it's bigger. You understand who you are as a person. And so you've had your gold tooth moment. Like, how, like, what is your role as a soldier? How are you doing it?
What I'm doing right now is that I've processed a lot of information, and I can boil it down into an understandable narrative. You know, as a writer, that is my golden role. Like, when I went back to Jamaica for the first time in a long time, one of my stops was at Marcus Garvey's statue in Jamaica. And, you know, there's a Heroes Park, and when I looked at the sculpture, my name was written on it, Marriott, because my granduncle was a sculptor who sculpted the Marcus Garvey statue. So
get the heck out of here, man.
That was a clear indication to me of what my role is, which is that I'm a scribe. I'm somebody that's going to document the process of gaining our freedom again.
Wow.
Wow.
Okay, yeah, so crazy. In terms of documentation, and this will probably be the last thing because we're getting the wrap it up sign from Prince here at Apio. But in terms of documentation, you're working on a film. Do you mind talking about that?
Yes, right. I mean, I don't mind, but okay. Actually, my main thing right now is to do films and television and books, all kind of talking about what I see. Like I said, we're in the midst of a Renaissance war, where it's there's a global African Renaissance all throughout the diaspora. We sometimes don't see it because there's so much distraction, but this is probably one of the most productive that we've ever been, Black people collectively.
That's word.
Yeah, that's true.
That's word.
I mean, if you were to really
just... You're giving me chills talking about this, because I feel it.
If you track...
If you
track what's going on right now, if you really see what Black people have been able to do, you know, post-Trump alone, it's incredible. It's an incredible list of accomplishments collectively. So I just want to, you know, be part of that renaissance. I just got a deal with Amazon where we're going to... track basically the history of hip hop from the 60s, really, which is where I think the generation that really made hip hop a global phenomenon was born during the riots. You know, they were riot babies. You know, the late 60s, early 70s created the generation that would become Biggie and Tupac. That cycle needs to be documented because every time one of our voices kind of rises up, it gets cut down, and there's been this ritual from, you know, Martin Luther King, Fred Hampton, Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, you know,
Garvey.
All of it goes to, you know, to Biggie and Tupac, to, you know, to now Nipsey Hussle. That American ritual keeps repeating itself, and we're going to have to find a way to break out of it, you know, out of that thing by creating a new narrative, you know, that doesn't end with the sacrifice of that voice. Mm.
Creating a new narrative that doesn't end with risking the sacrifice of that voice.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Rob, I gotta say, I feel like, I mean, we did this once before, and for those who don't know, Rob was one of our first interviews on Winging It as we were still trying to figure out how to be a Winging It podcast, and he's always been down for the culture and down for what we're doing because he sees it as something that's authentic. So we see ourselves as soldiers in the same fight, and one of the things that I hope we get a chance to do is to build on this in some way, shape, or form. Because we've run out of time today.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're out of time. It's one of those things.
That's the ultimate war, right? The war against time.
Exactly.
So how do people get in touch with you? How do they follow you? How do they see you? How do they get to know what you're doing and see your stories? Where do they need to go to find Rob Marriott?
The two things that will come out. I have a film that I'm working on called WAP's Last Bop. It's about the intergenerational conflict in hip hop as a film that should be really finished next year. And but the main thing is this television series that I'm working on now for Amazon called Criminal Minded. I'm writing it with my good friend Cheo Coco did Luke Cage.
Yeah.
And we are, like I said, going to kind of track the history of hip hop from the 60s to now.
Get out of here. Yeah, through a television series?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, this Amazon. Isn't documentary. This is, okay. This is.
It will be a documentary because I think that's going to be the cutting room floor. But this is, it's going to be a series of fictional.
That's dope, man. Yeah. That's dope. Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm excited about that.
Me too.
For our own call to action, please like us, follow us, do everything you can. Come check us out. You can check us out on iTunes, Spotify, Google, what have you, to actually subscribe to the podcast. And, of course, on social media, we are Winging It the Podcast on Instagram. And on Facebook, we are The Podcast
Winging It.
The Podcast Winging It. Thank you. Thank you. And please continue to tune in to what we've got and follow Rob Marriott and listen as you think about who you are as a listener to this show. Think about the culture that we attempt to preserve, and let Rob Marriott's words sing in your head. With that, we're out.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
This is Winging It, the podcast for people who don't have their shit together. Shit together.
That's all I'm trying to do. Hustle and motivate. Choppers and throwaway. Hustle the overweight. That's why they follow me, huh? They think I know the way. Cause I took control of things. Ballin' the solo way. And if you pattern my trend, I make you my protege. Slossin' that soldier race. Niggas don't know them days. Take you in back of the buildings. Make you expose your rage. Take you across the tracks. Make you explode the face. Now you official now. But you got a soul to save. I just been cooking that new. I'm about to drop in a few. Think if I call it the great, the people gon' call it the truth. I ain't really trip on the credit. I just paid all of my dues. I just
disrespected the game. Now my name all in the news. Tripping on all of my moves. Quote me on this, got a lot more to prove. Remember I came in this bitch, fresh out the county with nothing
don't
to lose.
Nothing. No. On the ground, oh. You. But I don't do this shit for nothing. No, no, no. Not at all. You. My money real.